from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Epic technical failures threw the Iowa caucuses into disarray yesterday, delaying the final results until today at the earliest. Amid the chaos, some Democratic candidates began declaring victory as others looked ahead to the next state primary in New Hampshire. Meanwhile, President Trump prepares for his third State of the Union address tonight. And while the Senate continues its debate on impeachment and prepares to vote tomorrow and issue an all but certain acquittal, we'll speak to a panel of journalists and we'll try to make sense of it all. Join us next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The 2020 primary season officially kicked off yesterday evening as Iowa voters gathered at caucus sites to choose among a field of Democratic presidential candidates, and the results are still not in. Massive technical failures sent the contest into chaos as officials blamed coding errors in a new app used to report the counts. And meanwhile, the Senate heard closing arguments in President Trump's impeachment trial yesterday and is set to hold a final vote tomorrow. And tonight, President Trump will deliver his third State of the Union address. We'll talk about the latest national political developments. And joining us, Chad Day, national political reporter with The Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the program. Good morning to you.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Philip Bump with us. He's national correspondent with The Washington Post. Welcome, Philip Bump.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And we'll be joined later by Jennifer Habercorn, congressional reporter with the LA Times. Let me begin, Chad Day, with you. And let's try to sort out what happened yesterday. I mean, at this point, it seems like, well, I'm quoting Paradise Lost. Maybe that's a little bit too epic, but chaos and old night, or a debacle at least.
Yeah, so that, you know, we expected this to be a new kind of reporting requirement that the Iowa Democratic Party was going to do. They were going to release different results. So they kind of set expectations that early on, they were like, this is going to be a more transparent process. We're going to try to get results out early. And then everything kind of fell apart. And so, as you mentioned earlier, you know, what they're saying now is that there was a problem with a phone app that they were going to use to record the results. And then they discovered this in the middle of the night and then had to go to, plan B, which was trying to do, you know, manual entry and trying to review a paper trail to do this. And that's delayed these results to where you saw candidates coming out not really knowing what to do and instead kind of declaring, a partial victory and then moving on to New Hampshire. So we're still kind of in a holding pattern here waiting for these results to come out.
There have been statements by the candidates, and let me go to you on this, Philip Bump. In fact, we heard kind of scathing remarks from the Biden campaign, but specifically Pete Buttigieg reminded me a little bit of Howard Dean. I mean, he wasn't hyped up like Howard Dean was back in 2004, but let's hear what Buttigieg had to say.
So we don't know all the results. But we know by the time it's all said and done, Iowa, you have shocked the nation. Because by all indications, we are going on to New Hampshire victorious.
So the question arises, Philip Bump, do the Buttigieg people know something that we don't know yet, or was that victory speech a little bit premature?
I mean, a little premature. I mean, to be fair, you know, by all indications, they were victorious. Everyone was tied at zero at the time that he gave that speech. I mean, I think that they had a speech plan to give. I think that the indications were that Buttigieg did fairly well. He was expected to, according to the polling. Some of the preliminary numbers that had come out, for example, even from Sanders' campaign, suggested Buttigieg had done well. And I think that they were just taking advantage of an opportunity to share a message. Was it accurate? Did they emerge victorious? I mean, I think we were going to see the campaigns sort of spin the results anyway. I mean, Buttigieg probably would have said he was victorious regardless of what the numbers actually show. So I think to some extent, what we heard last night is what we're going to hear anyway.
So what does this mean, Chad Day, with respect to the Trump operation? They did win the caucuses in Iowa. It's pretty patently clear, as expected. But also, Trump's sons were saying that this is revelatory of the fact that the Democrats can't run things competently and loss of confidence and all of that kind of rhetoric.
Yeah, I think that the president really seized on this to try to use this for his political gain. And, you know, I think that, you know, the Democratic Party, this is a bad look for them. It's a very embarrassing for them to not be able to hold, you know, the kind of kick off the primary season in the right way. And so, you know, I think you're going to see a lot of that. You may even see a little of that later on in the State of the Union. There might be a little bit of an off-the-cuff jab there. Not quite sure yet. But that would definitely be in line with the way the president's kind of set this up, where it's like, well, you know, kind of trying to take chaos that was here in Iowa and then turn that into and extrapolate it into, well, this is a problem with the entire Democratic field.
And Philip Bump, there was a 16% vote in the caucuses in the last election, and that was second highest ever in terms of the turnout. Do we have any idea what the turnout was yesterday?
Not really. I mean, we have sort of anecdotal assessments. It seems as though it was probably somewhat akin to what we saw in 2016, probably not what we saw in 2008, which was the record high for turnout. It's also not really clear what that necessarily means, even if it was the same as 2016, generally speaking. What does that indicate moving forward? Is it a function of the size of the field? Is it a function of people who haven't yet really made up their mind of who they want to support, you know, which could obviously change once Democrats are faced with a choice between a Democrat and President Trump? So, you know, there's a lot of – we're sort of stuck in this position where there are all these tea leaves that are being dumped on us fairly slowly, and we're trying to read them, but it's not necessarily clear what all of them mean.
What does this say to you, Phil Bump? I happened to read the article you did about Kenneth Starr and trustworthiness, and you hit pretty hard on the idea that trustworthiness is, shall we say, very vulnerable with respect to what went on in the impeachment vis-a-vis the Republicans. But what does this say to the American people in terms of just overall confidence in the process by which we elect our presidents?
Well, I would say that over the course of the past 24 hours and moving forward, probably the next 24 hours, people are going to feel a little shaky about it. I think we'll see in New Hampshire next week, barring something really dramatic, it'll be a normal election, and then we'll have a concrete example and we'll move past it. We tend to spend, you know, I mean, Iowa comes first. That means we spend months and months and months talking and thinking about Iowa, and then very quickly it sort of gets subsumed into the general flow of how the primary moves forward. You know, there's a lot of hand-wringing this morning. The Iowa caucus is doomed, yada, yada, yada. We'll see. You know, maybe this is hugely problematic for Iowa down the road, but I think we tend to overestimate in the moment the significance of things that are surprising shocks to us. And, you know, I'm not convinced that this will be something that has long-term resonance either within the primary or the broader general election.
Well, if we look at New Hampshire, Chad Day, there seems to be a lot of prognosticating that, and I don't want to make this into a race, although it's hard not to, that is, you know, to think of it as some kind of sporting event or something along those lines. But the reality is that in New Hampshire, there's a definite edge because of the geography of Bernie Sanders from Vermont and because of Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts.
Yeah, and I think you're seeing that bearing out in some of the early polling. You know, you've seen kind of the polling average showing Sanders up there. And you've also seen some indications that maybe the Biden campaign's not going to really, you know, compete as much as they want to. You know, basically trying to say we're going to focus more on Nevada and South Carolina. I do think that, you know, with the results being what they are, you know, usually you're able to get kind of some momentum coming out of Iowa. And sometimes that can kind of unsettle a little things in New Hampshire. In this case, I think it's as Philip was saying, it's kind of a wash. You know, you know, all the candidates basically are, you know, same thing as they were the day before. And so we have a very tightly clustered five at the top of this field. And, you know, we'll kind of see what kind of that looks for. But you're right, there is kind of a home field advantage there for those two candidates.
And we're talking, if you just joined us, with Chad Day and Philip Bump about politics. And we do invite you to join this conversation. In fact, if you have some thoughts or questions, now would be a good time to join us. And you can do that by calling our toll-free number. It's available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Let me repeat the number, 866-733-6786, or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org. Philip Bump, again, is national correspondent with the Washington Post, and Chad Day is national political reporter with the Wall Street Journal. How does impeachment really affect what's going on now with respect to not only the primaries, but let's talk about the big picture as well as the immediate picture here. Philip Bump, let's get a picture from you on this.
Sure. So frankly, I'm not sure that it has much of an effect. I was in New Hampshire over the weekend and talking to both volunteers and voters about how they were looking at the race. No one brought up impeachment unless I brought it up first, and then they kind of shrugged at it. You know, there's a lot of focus on beating Trump in November, but not really on using impeachment as a vehicle to do so. We saw data this morning from Gallup showing that President Trump's approval rating nationally has gone up to its highest point of his presidency. Clearly, impeachment didn't really do much to damage him there. But again, you know, there's a lot of time between now and the election. So I think that, you know, it's also easy to overread poll data like that in this moment to suggest that, you know, he may be surviving this and then even thriving off of it, which may end up not being the case over the long term.
Well, his numbers are up, Chad Day, and the economy looks pretty sound, and he's the incumbent, and that gives him a great number of advantages. I think the real question boils down to, when he gives a State of the Union speech tonight, is he going to stay on message, or is he going to be looking at people like Adam Schiff and Nancy Pelosi and come out with a kind of predictable or unpredictable wrath?
You know, the White House has kind of set this up saying, you know, this is going to be a positive speech. I think Trump has also said that as well. They're going to try to focus on accomplishments and USMCA and things like that. But this is an unpredictable president. And, you know, he punches back and talks about that often. And I think it might be very difficult for him to stand up there in front of the very body, you know, people that have been trying to remove him from office, particularly a large segment of the people in the room, and not take a shot at them, particularly whenever he's on kind of the cusp now of what will almost certainly be an acquittal by a Republican Senate. And so, you know, we'll see, but I think it's likely.
Well, in fact, there's been some speculation that, I'll call it buzz, if you will, that Democrats are going to set people like Nadler and Schiff in the position where they're looking directly at the president, or he can't see beyond them, or he, in his line of vision, if you will, and that will affect him perhaps, or that's what they're trying to orchestrate or try to bring about. I don't know if that's true or not, but it certainly seems plausible.
Yeah, I haven't seen that reporting. I'll have to take a look and talk to some of our congressional reporters as well. But one thing I want to go back to something that Phil said just a little bit ago is that, you know, I was in Iowa recently, and I also did not hear this come up as a voting issue. And when you talk to Democratic operatives and you talk about people who are looking not only at the presidential race but also the Senate race, they're not saying that that's what they're going to run on. And so, you know, whether or not the impeachment is something that's going to have any impact on the presidential election is still, that question is still a very open question. I think right now people are very much focused on their own lives and, you know, kitchen table issues and seeing if that's something that, you know, how they're going to grade the last 3 years.
Well, Jennifer Habercorn is joining us now, congressional reporter for the LA Times. Good morning, Jennifer. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi. Well, we're talking about the State of the Union speech, and it's going to be in Congress, and all the Democratic congressional representatives who voted for the impeachment will be there. We can only speculate about how this is going to affect the president, but let's talk about it from the congressional point of view. What do you see?
I was talking to a lot of Senate Republicans yesterday about what they're hoping to hear from the president, and Senate Republicans do not want impeachment to come up. They're trying to send the message to the president that the country wants to move on from impeachment, and he should too. Of course, a lot of those members are skeptical that the president will actually do that, that the president wouldn't use this opportunity to really talk about the coming acquittal vote, which is expected tomorrow in the Senate. And it's just a matter of wait and see if he's actually going to do it.
Well, he's talking about or his operatives are talking about this being a comeback speech, full of optimism and maybe even talking about unity. So he'll be heavy, presumably, on health care and prescription costs and things of that nature, national security.
Yeah, Republicans are hoping that he uses it to reset the agenda and to focus on things that they can accomplish. I would express some skepticism that, whatever kind of agenda he sets, that Congress is going to be ready to work with him. You know, there's a lot of kind of bad blood up here still about the impeachment process. Democrats are frustrated that the president did not take their impeachment inquiry seriously and rebuffed all attempts to get documents and his administration officials to participate. So it's a little hard to see how Congress and the White House goes from this really partisan impeachment battle straight to some kind of cooperation on policy. There also just hasn't been a lot of policy conducted in the last few years. That blame, you know, there's lots of blame to go around, whether that's the White House or Congress doing that. I think we're going to hear some of those lofty policy goals, and it's a matter of whether there's any sense of cooperation up here.
You think we'll hear the word bipartisan?
Definitely. It seems like one of those words that presidents love to talk about in their State of the Union speeches. If anything, I would sense that the White House would tout the fact that opposition to impeachment has been bipartisan. You know, they were able to pick up a couple Democratic votes in the House against the impeachment inquiry. And the White House and the president's lawyers are really hoping that they could do the same in the Senate, that one or two Democrats will vote to acquit the president, and that they're going to be able to call the impeachment process bipartisan in opposition. But I think we can definitely expect to hear bipartisan in that context.
Well, Joe Manchin of West Virginia is saying the president should be censured. That gives him a kind of pathway out if he indeed decides to vote with the Republicans. But the fact of the matter is that's probably not going to fly with Mitch McConnell, I assume.
Oh, definitely. Republicans have already said that censure is out of the question. I don't think that's really going to go anywhere. To your point, I do think it was viewed as a path out, that if Manchin does want to vote to acquit, he can say that he wanted to censure the president, which was viewed as kind of a middle ground. But Manchin has not decided how, or at least has not told everybody how he plans to vote. There are two other Democrats who are kind of considered in the mix, Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona and Doug Jones from Alabama. Neither of them have said how they're going to vote, and they're widely seen as swing votes, possible votes to vote to acquit the president.
We got a lot of callers, and I want to get to as many of you who are waiting on the line here as I can. But one more question, if I can go to you on this, Philip Bump, and that is the authors of the speech that's being written for the president tonight are Vince Haley and Ross Worthington, but probably under the, I imagine, aegis of Stephen Miller, we can expect, don't we?
Yeah, that's been the pattern in the past. I'll note that the White House is insistent that President Trump writes the speech himself.
I was going to make the same note, that these are his words and so forth. That is what they're insisting.
But yes, what we've heard from the president in past speeches, his State of the Union and then his address to Congress in 2017, have been efforts to be more presidential than he normally is in speeches. He tends not to have overt misrepresentations of facts so much as sort of cherry-picking data and things along those lines. He tries to use some of the more sweeping rhetoric we've heard from other presidents, although it sort of lands differently coming from him. You know, that's probably what we're going to hear tonight as well, but there's always that undertone of his core messages, things which are driven by Stephen Miller, the focus on immigration, the focus on the ways in which America isn't working the way that he wants it to work, and I think we can expect that tonight, too.
We can also, I think, Chad, they expect a good deal of talk from him about blue-collar jobs, no?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's an issue that, you know, they're kind of seeing this as a stage for them to be able to kind of set up and talk about issues that are going to come up in the election. And, you know, whenever you talk about blue-collar workers and states that they have to do well in, you know, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, that's going to be a message that they want to put out there and try to get in people's minds and saying, you know, reminding them of things that they see as their accomplishments, particularly now that they have a little bit of a stage with the attention from the Democratic side and some of the disarray in Iowa.
Let's go to our callers. And Cole, you're up first here. Welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you, Michael. I wanted to talk about the caucuses and say that this is, once again, a total embarrassment for the Democratic National Committee. And to point out that it's not just the first one. It's one of many that we've seen, like allowing a billionaire, Bloomberg, to kind of buy his way and then changing the rules to let him get in. Changing the rules for what, in the event of a contested convention. But mostly, I just want to say that with regards to this app and the debacle of what we saw last night and are still seeing today, that app was created by a company, ironically, entitled Shadow. It's very secretive, but if you dig into it, you'll find out they have ties to the corporate power structure of the Democratic elite. The Clinton administration, Clinton campaign has ties to it. Buttigieg and Biden all donated to this company. Once again, this is a gigantic bad look for the Democrats, who it seemed like they're once again subverting the will of the people in trying to pick somebody on their own, or at least put their thumb on the scale, like we saw in 2016 against Bernie Sanders.
And although it's more reminiscent in many ways, I think, Cole, of what happened initially with the mess with the Affordable Care Act, with the simply the website just not working. I'm wondering, you're talking a little bit conspiratorial here, and let's hear Philip.
It's not a conspiracy, Michael, if it's actually happening. I mean, the reality is this is going on, and you can't talk about, like, for the past 2 weeks or however many months you want to go back about election tampering with the, you know, with the president and, you know, trying to affect election results and then actually engage in election tampering.
Well, there's certainly a lot of rivalry here and superdelegates come back to mind and all of that. I wonder, can we get your take on it, Chad Day?
Sure. You know, I would kind of urge caution right now. We don't actually know all that much yet. We know a little bit about what the party has said about there being a coding issue. This seems to be a problem where data was coming in. The results are actually being tabulated correctly, but then they were being reported out incorrectly. It sounds like it was a bug in the system. Whether or not, you know, there's some other thing going on there, where, you know, people are looking at that right now. We have reporters that were also digging into that very deeply. But one thing I would also say is that when you're talking about, you know, allegations of, you know, votes being changed and things like that, one of the things that the Iowa Democratic Party did do with this is they put a paper backup in. And that's why, you know, we didn't get any results last night, as they said, we found a problem and now we're having to go back and go to all of these kind of pieces of paper and put everything back together and make sure that the results are accurate. And so I would urge people to, you know, kind of take a breath and have some caution here as we kind of let this kind of play out a little bit. And the other thing about caucuses is that there's people in them all the time. There's reporters walking through that know the totals. And so it would be very difficult for someone to actually change the totals or things like that, because it is such an open process.
So, but if I may, and let me go to you on this, Philip Bum, Cole's call evokes a whole lot of what is going on here. I think the nuances of what's going on, what are going, maybe even not that nuanced. There's, as I said earlier, terrible rivalry between the moderates on the Democratic side and those who are on the farther left side of things. And there's a great deal of suspicion and enmity, and that's either going to have to be overcome by the Democrats or they're going to find many, many more obstacles along the way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's important to note, too, that this is President Trump's team has been very active already. I mean, even before the voting happened yesterday, they were saying that it was going to be rigged and that the establishment was trying to take down Bernie Sanders. Because in 2016, they ran that play and they tried to get Bernie Sanders supporters to be skeptical of how the DNC, how the party was treating their candidate so that they would have an advantage and maybe those people wouldn't come out and vote for Hillary Clinton. Probably that worked to some extent. They're doing the same thing now, intentionally fostering these same sorts of theories. We saw Lindsey Graham promoting this conspiracy theory, too. And, of course, it is a conspiracy theory. It is a theory about a conspiracy. You know, some of what the caller said was inaccurate, you know, in terms of the funding that was going to this company. You know, they were hired by different campaigns to use their products. But it really is the case that this really gets to the heart of when we are considering how elections run in America today, the extent to which people have trust in the system, as your question earlier asked, is important. And this is another example of how that distrust can be used to advance people's political agendas in a way that is not necessarily illustrative of what's actually happening.
And I know I have to say goodbye to you, Philip Bum, but I want to express appreciation for your being with us, and I thank you for being with us.
Of course. Thank you, sir.
Philip Bum, national correspondent for The Washington Post, and we just got word that we will get word at about 5 p.m., I guess, Eastern time, in terms of the majority results in the Iowa caucuses. In the meantime, we'll continue. We'll hear from you, our listeners. You can join us at our toll-free number. We invite you again to do that. It's 866-733-6786. Or you can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Or email any questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. We got Chad Day with us, national political reporter with The Wall Street Journal, and Jennifer Habercorn, congressional reporter for the LA Times. We'll hear from you again when we return. Stay tuned. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Chad Day of The Wall Street Journal and Jennifer Habercorn of the LA Times. And you, our listeners, and let me go to another caller here. Stanley joins us. Stanley, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Yes, I'd like to talk a little bit about a troubling timeline of events. The first being that the Des Moines Register poll was pulled at the last minute on election eve at request of Mayor Pete's campaign. Number two, Politico runs a story saying that rivals tell Bernie Sanders not to declare victory. Three, Pete Buttigieg declares victory. And four, Bernie Sanders was robbed on primetime TV to speak to millions of voters. And Michael, the caller earlier, was right about that app. It's a shady Democratic super PAC app, and it's not adding up. Bernie is going to win this thing, and they robbed him of the narrative. So instead of today about the Bernie surge and Biden being defeated, where's the narrative at? Bernie's harmed by the narrative, and I don't trust this process, quite frankly, and I hope this same app is not used in Nevada. And the word is they're going to use it in Nevada.
Well, there's going to be a lot more distrust as a result of this, and you, I think, are echoing that, Stanley, and I thank you for the call. Jennifer Habercorn, you want to comment here?
Well, yeah, I think you're exactly right that this is just going to tap into distrust that grassroots Democratic voters have in the process. I mean, we saw in 2016 that grassroots Democratic voters were very frustrated with the allegations that the DNC was really tipping the scales away from Bernie Sanders and toward Hillary Clinton. And you know, whether when we know at the end of the day what happened here in Iowa, I think no matter what happens, there's just going to be allegations and an aura of mistrust that the establishment is getting too involved in the process and putting their hand on the scales in a way that they shouldn't be. And that's going to hurt the whole process.
It's also going to hurt, Chad Day, the Democratic Party. No doubt about that, is there?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think whenever you're talking about, you know, divisions in the party, there definitely is, you know, this kind of huge gap between liberal, younger voters, people who are more distrustful of the system, you know, kind of anti-establishment, very attracted to Bernie Sanders and the message there, and then older, more moderate voters. And, you know, when you see the polling, and you kind of, we were looking back at some of the Wall Street Journal, NBC News polling recently, you know, you see these kind of older, more moderate Democrats that actually look a lot like younger Republicans right now. And so, you know, that is something that a candidate that's trying to emerge in this field is going to have to deal with. Whether it is Bernie Sanders, he's going to have to try to appeal to moderates who may be uncomfortable with some of what he's trying to do, some of his policies that would kind of revolutionize and change, you know, the fundamental nature of the government. And if it's a moderate or particularly someone like Mr. Buttigieg, I think you're going to see these kinds of arguments that the caller echoed come up where, you know, distrustful of him being, you know, seen as an establishment candidate.
Here's Rochelle, who posts on Facebook, and I'll go to you on this, Chad Day. Shouldn't we stop using computer programs for voting until it's perfected?
You know, there's a lot of people making that argument this morning. And, you know, I think that when you can see how quickly a small bug, or I don't know how large it is, but, you know, a bug in a system like this can affect an entire election and not only, you know, have results come in. And then, you know, even though they stopped the process and they said we're not going to issue any results and it doesn't appear as if any results went out that would have been inaccurate, it hurts the system. And so I think you are going to see a lot of election officials who are looking at this and saying, like, we don't want to look like Iowa.
And here's Bryce joining us from Burlingame. Bryce, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me. I actually wasn't going to call in, but then I'm so troubled to hear so many people calling in, you know, alleging that there's some kind of conspiracy against Bernie Sanders rather than, hey, democracy is kind of messy. These caucuses are just a messy format, and you've got thousands of people showing up and switching groups, and they've got a paper record, and they'll sort it out, and apps don't work half the time. Anybody who uses an iPhone knows their apps break down all the time. And it's just, it sounds like the Trump people and the QAnon people, and it's just so troubling to hear that rather than, yeah, we'll wait for the results to come out, because there's, it doesn't have to be a conspiracy. And then it destroys, it breaks apart the whole party, and nobody can have a reasonable discussion about the right candidate.
Well, we thank you for the comment, Bryce. Good to hear from you. And I'm going to read a tweet here from a listener who writes, note for the Bernie conspiracy nuts, the DNC does not manage the individual primaries and caucuses. They set the general rules, and the state parties run the process. I think that's correct, Jennifer Habercorn?
You know, yes, technically that is correct. But I think the average voter looks at any establishment group, whether it's the DNC or a state Democratic Party, as one and the same. That's not a fair characterization, but I think that's how the average voter would look at this process.
And Kim writes, and I'll go to you on this, Jennifer. Kim writes, please explain how Iowa is Democratic voting. If the person chooses a candidate who is below 15%, their vote is canceled and they have to choose someone else. This system is archaic and exclusionary.
The person definitely has a point that it's a complicated process and it's not direct representation. We will, at the end of this process, we're supposed to be able to see the division of how many people went to which candidate. But the caucus is not designed to tally that number. The caucus is designed to test viability. So if you had 10 people in every caucus, there were nearly 1,700 throughout the state, who supported a particular candidate, but 40, 50, 60, 70, 100 people supporting other candidates in those caucuses, their votes essentially don't count. And that's a process that was designed to ensure that, the vote is not too far divided, too many candidates being counted, and they want to coalesce around the most viable candidates.
We also have, though, Chad Day, to go back to the Iowa caucus system and how it works or doesn't work, we also have three different results that come in. And I don't believe there are any coin flips this year, but, it seems to be a metaphor in many people's minds for just how shaky this whole process can be.
Yeah, and I think that's why you're seeing people this morning say, maybe we need to do away with this process. They tried to come up with a compromise where they were going to have a first alignment where you had raw vote, then you had a second alignment raw vote, and those were all going to be released. And then you would have the SDEs, the state delegate equivalents that were released, which are really the ones that kind of declare whether you're the winner. And when you get into that kind of complicated math, and then you have this on top of it, you have problems with the results. I think that you're going to see people kind of rethink that. One thing I would say also about this, and going back to what Bryce said, is that a lot of this is a problem of expectation setting. The Iowa Democratic Party, when they came out of this, said this app's going to let us, get results faster. And they tried to set everybody up by saying, this is going to be, we're going to have early results. We're going to be able to get this done quickly, when, maybe they should have said, we're doing a lot of different things here and there's a lot of moving pieces and it's going to take a while, because there's a lot of states across the union that it takes a while to count votes.
I'm going to read another comment from David, who writes, knowing how other people vote often influences how people who haven't yet voted cast their ballot. Is not knowing the results from Iowa necessarily a bad thing? Is there something to be said for not releasing results until everyone everywhere has voted? Let me go to another caller. That's you, Stephen. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, Mike. I had a question about the general primary system in general, what the guests and you think about rotating, and you've probably heard this idea before, but I'd like to hear it on broadcast, about rotating the states that as they participate in the primaries, so that let's say it was New Jersey as the first state, and that they rotate not just the first few states, but all the states in general, so that it'll be a different set of states that ends up and starts out and so on. So I'd like to hear their...
Chad Day, you want to respond to that? Make it more, shall we say, arbitrary and a little bit like a draft or something?
I think realistically you probably won't see something like that. However, there are people that are talking about the fact that the early states right now are not representative of the demographics of the larger parties. And so I do think that you are seeing people that are going to use this to be able to say, we need to have a state that leads off that is more representative and is not, Iowa is a very, very white state, and that is not reflective of the larger Democratic Party.
90% white, in fact. And let me thank the caller and go right to another caller, and that's you, Mary. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that I think it's great to do all this analysis, and I'm a very analytical person. But at the same time, I think sometimes this platform ends up being a platform that sows seeds of doubt and also frustration and anxiety. And I think it's really important to have a very, very clear sense of what is analytical and useful and what is overanalyzing and leading to certain mindsets that aren't really positive and helpful. Thank you.
All right. I'll let that comment stand. I thank you for it. We'll get to another caller right away. Jonathan, that's you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for having this discussion. The Iowa Democratic Party has been adamant that this was not a hack, but we know in 2016, the Republican Party and the Russians collaborated to cheat and steal the election using hacking. How can the IDP be so sure that their app wasn't hacked?
Jennifer Habercorn.
Yeah, that's definitely a great question, and it's one that I know a lot of reporters are asking the Iowa Democratic Party right now. I don't think they've provided a clear answer but to why they think it wasn't hacked, but they have said that it wasn't. And I think that's going to be a question that I'm hopeful that smart reporters in Iowa keep pressing the Democratic Party on, because it's definitely raising a lot of concerns.
They said that it wasn't, but really, Chad Day, how do they know?
I mean, I think that, you know, we still don't know a lot about the process of vetting this app. You know, they've said that, you know, oh, we had a cybersecurity company come in and reviewed the app and did a review to make sure that it was secure. But, you know, we don't know the name of that company yet. We don't know a lot of details about how the app functions. And, you know, I think this is just going to be something that, you know, as she says, it's going to be a reporting line that is going to be very important over the next, you know, couple days, weeks, and possibly even months as we look ahead to other places that might be using apps for this.
Let me go to more calls. Let me go next to you. Pete, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to make the point that these conspiracy theories being propagated by Sanders supporters, to me, are just another example of them wanting to have it both ways, since they are the most ardent supporters of the caucus tradition. Because they tend to dominate them, as opposed to traditional primaries where they don't do so well. And they can't have it both ways. This chaos is on them as much as anyone else.
Well, you sound like you're in a gale there, Pete, but I thank you for that comment, and we'll let it stand and get right to another caller, and that's Alex from San Francisco. Good morning.
Hi. I was wondering if I don't wholly understand how the caucus system works. Could you compare it to how ranked choice voting works?
Well, Chad Day, you want to make that comparison?
Oh, man, here we go. A caucus system is where, you know, you go to different caucus sites. You are there to kind of divide up in a room where you can see how everybody else is dividing up. And so it's very much an interactive process. There is a threshold of 15% where a candidate in that room, in that particular room, a candidate has to get 15% of the people in that room to be viable. This year, they made it where after the first round, you know, everybody kind of gets into their groups. They then count up. They determine who's viable. And then if you were in a viable group, you are stuck there. Before, in past years, you were able to move around. Now you're stuck there. And then the people who are not with a viable candidate then divide up and move around. With ranked choice voting, you know, the difference there is that you're actually in a ballot. You know, you're filling out a paper ballot in a booth by yourself, and you're saying 1, 2, and 3.
And Jennifer Habercorn, if I go back to you, you know, we were talking before about the speech which will be delivered by the president tonight, the State of the Union speech, and what to expect. And again, there's no accounting for whether or not he's going to stay on message and be presidential and be optimistic and unifying and all that. But the speech will be written for him. Any expectation of what he might say about immigration, particularly since obviously, the Republicans are concerned about those who are jockeying to be reelected, and the upcoming election could affect them one way or the other.
Yeah, we don't have any idea what he's going to say yet on immigration, if he's going to address the subject at all. But you're definitely right that it's a subject that I'm sure Republicans would love to see addressed in the speech, or I should say some might not want him to address it in the speech, but it's definitely a front runner for one of the policy areas that he could dive into. I would think particularly ahead of 2020 and this question popping up throughout the election process, for sure.
Well, is there fear from Republican representatives of some kind of, for lack of a better way to describe it, a blue wave coming up here?
Yeah, I think Republicans are concerned that the blue wave of 2018 that we all talked about hasn't really crested yet, and that that could continue in 2020. I mean, I think even just looking at the impeachment process, both sides right now are declaring victory in that impeachment has really riled up the base on both sides, and it's going to be a question of turnout. You know, we're not seeing a lot of Trump voters flip to say that they're going to support a Democrat. And maybe that will change once there's a Democratic nominee. But if it's true that not a lot of folks have changed their mind about how they feel about the president, the question in 2020 is going to be turnout. And frankly, it's going to be turnout in just a handful of states. And so, you know, immigration is one of those issues, kind of like healthcare that we saw in 2018, that could really drive a lot of enthusiasm and drive people out to vote, whether it's people who are turning out in support of the policies outlined by the president or in opposition to them.
But how is impeachment affecting voter attitudes, in your judgment? Is there any evidence, for example, that it's dictating how people choose among Democratic candidates?
No, I don't think it's affecting how Democratic voters are choosing between the Democratic candidates, except for one thing, and I think we're seeing, and we saw in some of the entrance polls in Iowa, particularly by CNN yesterday, that the ability to beat Trump is a very significant factor for Democratic voters. And so I think that it is definitely tied into the impeachment process because, you know, we saw the impeachment arguments played on cable television all day throughout the Senate trial. And so I think that's definitely playing a part in how Democratic primary voters are going to choose their Democratic candidate.
Well, here's a comment apropos from Bradley, who writes, this is precisely the moment and the situation where each and every candidate should step forward to demonstrate their true leadership qualities by encouraging their supporters to keep their cools and come together in support of the larger Democratic interest, which is to unseat Trump. And here is Han joining us from Oakland. Good morning. You're on the air. Han, are you there? No? Okay. Let me go to another caller then. Let me go to Ken. Ken, join us, please.
Hello. This is I'm calling from Vallejo. I'm calling to say that it's not true that what somebody said earlier about how mostly younger voters are supporting Bernie and the older people tend to be more moderate. I'm 72 years old. I majored in economics in college. I've been a socialist since then. I honestly believe there's a conspiracy. I used to poo-poo all of these conspiracy theories, didn't believe in them. I'm convinced there was a conspiracy last time against Bernie to put Hillary. The Democratic Party leadership had a conspiracy to prevent Bernie last time in last election. I wrote in Bernie's name, even though he wasn't on the ballot. And the same thing's happening right now. Bernie would have won, and it would have been a tremendous impetus for him to move forward. And I honestly believe there is a Democratic conspiracy to stop Bernie. And I intend to vote for him, just like I did last time. And if he's not on the ballot, I'm going to write his name in. But I do believe there's a Democratic conspiracy.
All right, Charlie, I thank you for your opinion. Good to hear from you. I'm wondering, though, Chad Day, and all this talk about conspiracy against Bernie Sanders, you know, there is a real issue here that those in the moderate camp in the Democratic Party not only look at Bernie Sanders as someone probably who's unelectable because he's a socialist, and the Trump campaign would bring up Venezuela and the Soviet Union where he had his honeymoon and all that kind of stuff. We know those talking points. But also the realization that a lot of socialist principles would not get through a legislature, even if it was a Democratic legislature.
Yeah, I think that, it's going to be a choice when people are talking about this and appraising candidates right now. I think that you hear a lot of people talk about how they agree with the principles, they agree with the ambition, they agree with, trying to shake up a system that they see as unequal, as stacked against them. And I think that Bernie Sanders taps into that very well. And a lot of what he says does that. But when you get into a voter that's looking for pragmatic solutions, you know, that's where they're going to have a little bit of reservations with him. Although one point I would make, though, is that there hasn't been a lot of legislative movement, over the last few years, even from people who are calling for bipartisanship. This is still a very polarized country. I think that, you know, as this progresses, if you do see a Sanders surge, I think you're going to see a lot of moderates say, well, you know, they're going to be motivated by that. You know, we want to beat Trump, from a Democratic perspective. And that's probably, you know, is that the, you know, choice between Trump and him? I think they might see people go ahead and if they're in the moderate camp, move that way.
But Sanders was surging in Iowa. And I think it's
that's
a
correct
fait accompli that many would have been deeply concerned about that.
Yeah, I think that, Iowa, particularly this year, with there being such a stratified field, you know, you have five top candidates like that, and you particularly have three candidates that are kind of in the moderate lane. That was something that, you know, when you're just looking numbers wise, was very beneficial to Bernie Sanders, who has a very dedicated support, group of supporters and who are very active on the ground there. And so I think that's right. I think, you know, Bernie Sanders was poised to do very well. The polling showed that. And then, you know, today at 5 p.m., we'll see how he did.
And we'll see or hear next from Charlie and what he has to say. Charlie, you're on the air.
Hi there. Yeah, thank you. I just want to know, last night, you know, your reporter, Dominic Montanaro, made a great point
about how, you know, there was just a lot of lack of transparency in the process with the new application. And I just think that just the lack of transparency about the new systems that are being rolled out are what's creating a void for speculation. And I'm totally on agree with, you know, the criticism for the conspiratory arguments. But I think there is just this void that's created, especially with the lead up of the change of the debate rules for Bloomberg and then taking away the Des Moines Register poll last minute. And then last night, it does create an environment when there is a lack of distrust. And I think that everybody could have done a better job with being transparent about all of these decisions, why they're being made, instead of creating this situation where now we do may have an honest error at hand, but just because of the decisions that have been made within this context, in this environment, it is leading to this, moment of concern and distrust.
Your questions about transparency are on target here, Charlie, and I thank you for them. And I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Forum, and we're talking to Chad Day and Jennifer Habercorn, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to another caller here. Let me get Donna on. Donna, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to bring up that, you know, all the media stations are talking about electability and who can beat Trump. And, you know, everyone's only looking at who can most of the Democratic Party get behind. But in order to beat Trump, we need bipartisan support. And the guy who's not getting a whole lot of attention but actually has the most favorability between both parties is Andrew Yang. And I'm really surprised that he's not getting more attention for that.
Well, he's the only, at this point, left standing who is not of Caucasian extraction. Jennifer Habercorn, I want to assess Andrew Yang's possibilities here to respond to Donna's call.
Yeah, I think she raises a good point. The early numbers that I was seeing, at least in the coverage last night, showed that he was not doing great in Iowa. You know, maybe that will change once the campaign gets to a place like South Carolina, which is much more diverse than Iowa and New Hampshire. Maybe that'll be a factor. But I think she's right that he's definitely different from the rest of the field, one of the only non-Caucasians left. And, as of right now, it doesn't seem like he has a chance at one of those 1, 2, and 3 slots in Iowa or New Hampshire. But if anything, this process last night has shown us that it's probably not wise to make substantial predictions.
Well, it is unwise. And yet, Chad Day, I wonder why Yang's candidacy hasn't received more momentum. A lot of people like what he's talking about with giving away money. I mean, it does appeal to many in the body politic.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, he also has a pretty unifying message. Whenever he goes out, particularly on debate stages, he's somebody who is able to really communicate to people who are dissatisfied with the system and are looking for new ideas. And, I would also say that he also put a lot of money into Iowa. And so, regardless of whether he, finishes, in a top spot or his candidacy is able to survive over the next few weeks, he's also injected a lot of different ideas into this. Into the process that are going to have to be addressed by the top candidates because, he's putting millions of dollars into television ads across a state that was very, has influential voters.
And again, Chad Day is national political reporter with the Wall Street Journal. Jennifer Habercorn is congressional reporter with the LA Times. And Jennifer, can you give us a sense of what is likely to happen now? What are we going to expect the rest of the day and tomorrow with respect to impeachment, other than an acquittal, a likely acquittal?
That's right. And before then, senators are spending today and half of the day tomorrow giving speeches explaining their votes. In most cases, we kind of know how senators are going to vote. There is very little chance of many Republicans voting against acquitting the president or many Democrats not voting for conviction. But there are still a few outstanding folks who we don't know where they're going to land. So we'll be watching to see if those senators explain their vote in speeches today or tomorrow. And then at 4 o'clock Eastern tomorrow, the Senate will vote on the acquittal. Of course, the Constitution requires 67 votes to remove the president. And considering that there's only 47 Democrats in the Senate, that number is going to fall far short. And there's not much suspense outside of those two, three, four people who could vote against their party.
And let me bring Barbara on here as we come to the close of this hour. Barbara, you're on. Morning.
Thanks. I'm a computer scientist, and I want to talk about what happened in Iowa. The fact that they used an app for the very first time in a major situation, it's almost as if they were doomed to fail. The secrecy surrounding it, the lack of external vetting, it was there are all these conspiracy theories which I think don't hold water. The fact is that what they did was really bad from a technical perspective. It could have been worse because Iowa and Nevada both wanted to allow people to vote over the phone in these caucuses, and fortunately the DNC stopped that. They probably weren't able to stop this because of the argument that, well, these aren't real ballots. We can always back it up with phones. But it was just a really stupid thing to have done. It was almost designed to fail. And, you know, I just wish that policymakers would bring in computer security experts early on and not listen to the advocates for these bad systems, especially blockchain voting, which is like the worst of the worst.
Barbara, I have to ask you, you think there's a possibility of a hack having happened or occurred, like some listeners are saying?
Well, it's too early to say that it hadn't. I mean, my guess is that they may have found a problem with the software, a vulnerability in the software, a bug. And that could be an explanation, but in terms of determining if there was a hack, you know, that can take a long time to really work out. So I would say it seems unlikely that it was hacked, but I don't see how anyone can say definitively that it wasn't at this point.
Well, I thank you for the call and appreciate your call and appreciate all of you who have called in this hour, and certainly want to express my appreciation also to Chad Day of The Wall Street Journal and Jennifer Habercorn of the LA Times and Philip Bump, whom we spoke to earlier, The Washington Post. Thanks to all of you, and thanks to you, our listeners. We have another hour of Forum coming up, and stay tuned for it. We're going to get into some local issues in the hour ahead. We're going to talk about a plan by State Senator Scott Wiener to actually take over, state takeover of PG&E, and we're also going to talk about what's going on Market Street, getting local in the hour ahead. That's up ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.